All right, hour number two of the Hoffman Show here on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Also live now on iHeartRadio and TuneIn Radio, so making it nice and easy to, go find whoever it is, or your favorite show, wherever it is that you typically listen. Coming up at 6 o'clock, Clinton Yates, a rare Monday visit. He is going to chime in on the news of the day. Figured that was probably worth having Clinton on a Monday for, to say the least, because, you know, we got the Rizzo and the Rizzo and Davey news. But as for right now, in just a second here, we'll get to Not My Beat, waiting on Chelsea Janes for a quick second, and then we will be good to go. So while we wait for Chelsea, I'll also tell you, coming up at 5:30, Anthony, I think we play a little bit of a game around this news. We can take a look at some of the highest paid players in baseball. And the reason I want to do this is because I think that we probably haven't heard of a lot of them as guys that aren't super locked in on baseball. But I think we're going to be pretty surprised at how, I think a lot of people will be surprised at how many guys they haven't heard of make a lot of money, which I want to use to make a larger point about where the Nats go. So that's coming up at 5:30. Right now, though, we got Chels, so it's time for Not My Beat.
Today's top story, from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not My Beat.
Ooh, when there's big baseball news, you know we call Chelsea Janes, the Washington Post. Chelsea is with us now. And Chelsea, before we get into the whys and the important stuff, just like, it's Sunday afternoon. I was making dinner is what I was doing. The Nats had played earlier in the day. The MLB draft is a week away. We're almost at the All-Star break. When you got the call from whoever it was from, whether it was a source, whether you saw it from someone else, whatever it is, how you found out, what was your, like, as a human being who is covering this, what was your reaction to the news that Mike Rizzo and Davey Martinez got fired yesterday?
I was just shocked. You know, my stomach dropped, I think, because I hadn't expected it. And it was so, you know, it's probably one of the biggest things that's happened to the Nationals in the time I've paid attention to them. It's just a huge shift. And it happened, I would say, very suddenly. So, yeah, I was just kind of like watching another game and saw it and just kind of, I was like, I had to stop for a second because I was just kind of so shocked by it.
It's so incredibly shocking, yet so easily explainable, which is a bizarre thing. Like, if you're not following this to try to explain to people, it's like, no, like, of course, like, they're bad. They've been bad for a long time. This makes all the sense. But I thought Barry had a great line in his column. I'm sure you read it and have seen it. And if not, you guys have talked about it. Of Rizzo and Davey both felt really comfortable. And he noted that at spring training, that it felt like everyone felt a little too comfortable. And the reason is because this group has been together so long. So ultimately, what shifted here that the Learners decided to make this move, and especially right now, a week before they have the number one pick in the draft?
You know, we don't know for sure. You know, but everyone was so comfortable that, you know, there were people in the organization in spring training wondering, like, what short of just sort of a literal, like, crime being committed would force change in those two roles, because they've been there a long time. You know, they're respected people, you know, Davey and Riz, well-liked, they're very friendly, you know, they've got all the relationships. So, you know, it was going to take a lot. And I don't know what it took, you know, ultimately, but I think part of it is that the Learners came up against the deadline to pick up their options for next year for Rizzo and Davey. And they probably realistically looked at themselves and said, like, we can't do that. The team's not playing well enough. And if that's the case, then we probably shouldn't let them make the pick next week. And, you know, we'll have to go another direction. But, you know, that's just sort of how my mind works. We really haven't seen the Learners sort of do things logically before. So I don't know if that's what they were thinking, but I think you could see that rationale.
Chelsea Janes, Washington Post, with us here on the Hoffman Show. Do you think that Davey's presser about a month ago, where he said, oh, it's on the players, and he walked that back in fairness to him, but that felt weird. That felt off. That felt different. Do you think that that had anything to do with it and whatever may have happened behind the scenes after those comments?
I do think it had something to do with it, but only in the sense that it was embarrassing. You know, I think, you know, it just called attention to how badly they were doing. And the Lerner family has traditionally really not liked that. Like, they don't like to be embarrassed. And I think, you know, whatever Davey said, like, I don't think, you know, guys in the clubhouse hated him or anything close to it. I think they loved him. I think they knew that, you know, that's Davey. You know, every once in a while he'll get emotional and say something. Like, I don't think anyone really was saying, we can't live with this guy here. But I also don't think he was, you know, a particularly inspiring figure for them. I think he was just part of the furniture at this point. And so something had to change. You know, but I don't think the Lerners looked at those comments and said, you know, this is a fireable offense. I think it was more like it brought attention to something that was negative that they had kind of been ignoring. And then they sort of had to reckon with the fact that people were criticizing their franchise as much as they have the last few weeks.
So when we talk about fairness in terms of people getting fired, it is like the most heinous and cold thing we do in sports media. But ultimately, I guess there's a part of it that's like kind of our jobs is to look at a situation, give our best analysis, do as much homework as we can. So I am acknowledging the human side of this on the front end of the question, Chelsea, and to whatever extent you want to feel comfortable doing the same, especially you knew Mike and you knew Davey from years of covering them, by all means. But you talk about like the blame for the Nationals' failure and doing a job that is up to the par of keeping the job in an incredibly competitive industry. How did Mike and Davey actually do at their jobs, let's say post World Series? We know what the record is, but also like a lot of blame gets thrown at ownership or at other things. When you look at their role in it, like how much culpability is there?
Yeah, you know, I think that's one of the reasons this is surprising is because it wasn't super easy to point the finger at any one of them individually or even together. I mean, you know, obviously a franchise is doing poorly. The manager and general manager are culpable, but also, you know, ownership has given them almost nothing to work with since the World Series. They pretty much mandated a teardown of the roster that won the World Series and then didn't give any financial resources with which to build it up. So yes, you know, I think firing the manager and general manager gives you a chance to have a fresh start and set a new direction, but the direction was set by ownership. And I think that is important to remember. That being said, I think it was pretty clear that, like I said, I think Dave Martinez had become part of the furniture. I don't think that means he was having a negative impact. I just don't think he and his coaches were making people better or getting messages across. I think it was pretty clear from sort of the way they didn't take any steps forward this year as a team that they needed a new voice in there. So that one makes sense. Rizzo, I also think you can look at and say, this makes sense. You know, the roster's not there. We're in year, three, four, five of this rebuild, depending where you started. And we're not seeing the leaps forward that we want to see. I mean, James Wood looks straight and we're not even better, you know. So I think you can look at both of them and think there's a reason to fire them and reason to believe things will get better when they leave. But they're, you know, firing them does not guarantee that things will get better. And that is the problem that ownership poses to this franchise, is that you don't necessarily trust them to make the right moves in situations like these.
So let me ask you this to try to get some context here for those of us that are not locked into every team baseball-wise, which would include the question asker here, me. If you compare like the resources that the Nationals have compared to a team like the Rays, who are consistently competitive despite not spending very much money on payroll, if not spending much money anywhere, like how do those two teams compare in terms of what they put into it, how they spend resources, and kind of the what's available to build a winning team?
Yeah, so the Rays are geniuses because they don't get much from their ownership either. But what they do, they allocate to player development, to data, you know, to analyzing. You know, when people say analytics, there's a lot that goes into that. But one of the things the Rays do is they just analyze player performance to the point that, you know, they're acquiring players that fit their exact idea of, say, how a catcher should frame pitches. You know, can we make this guy our kind of catcher? They have analysts dedicated to, for example, just catchers, you know, just how to make them better at the tiniest thing. So not only coaches, but people in data who are looking at this stuff and thinking about it as their jobs. With the Nationals, there are people in data and they are looking at how to make people better and they are doing their best, but there's not this huge sort of emphasis on every little detail of a player before you acquire him, you know, as you develop him. It's just more old school where it's, you know, you tell them these things and yeah, they have the information, but they are not obsessing over little things, I think, the way successful organizations these days are. And maybe that was a winning formula even 5-10 years ago. I mean, it clearly it was. But the way things have changed, you just can't cross your fingers and hope people get better. You have to work with them. You have to, you know, mold young players into exactly what you want them to be or cut bait. And the Nats just haven't done that.
So is that part of it, like Rizzo, even in some of the stuff I was reading today from across the baseball world, like he's described as an old school kind of guy. Is that a Rizzo driven thing, or did Mike at times go to ownership and say, I need this or I want this, and was told, no, we're not paying for that?
I think both. You know, I think we will never know what the Nationals player development staff and stuff would look like without, you know, if it hadn't been Mike Rizzo for the last few years. But he did put, you know, he did overhaul, you know, a lot of their player development staff. They really have started incorporating all the technology that everyone else has when it comes to, you know, analyzing pitching spin and stuff like that. But I think he also was not the kind of person who based everything in the organization around that stuff, you know. So, yeah, probably they would look a little different if ownership had given more resources to invest in various things in the minor leagues. But I also think that those, the things that are important to Mike Rizzo as a general manager are not necessarily in line with like what the data spits out. So I think it's a little bit of both.
So with that said, Rizzo's 64 years old. Chelsea Janes is with us on the Hoffman Show, of course, Major League Baseball reporter for the Washington Post, does an outstanding job, was on the Nats beat for a long time, and now covering baseball as a whole writ large. But when you scope the, like, I'm sure you've taken in reaction from all kinds of people around baseball, Rizzo's 64. Is this his last GM job? Is he going to go work in another club? Like, what do you think is next for Mike Rizzo based off of what people around baseball think of him and what how he thinks about the game compared to some of the things that we were just talking about?
Yeah, I think it's his last GM job, but not because there aren't people in the game who respect him, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. I think he's a well-respected person. People think really highly of the way he traded, the way he scouts. You know, they haven't had a ton of luck in the draft lately, but I think he maintains a reputation as someone who kind of knows what they're looking at with that stuff. So I would expect him to be sort of a special assistant, you know, somewhere if he wants to work at all. I don't know. But I don't think he won't get another job because people think he's an idiot in any way. You know, right. It's not that at all. I don't think he'll get another GM job purely because he's just not what these front offices are looking for anymore. You know, they want the really numbers heavy guys, for better or for worse. You know, obviously, you know, in 2019, Rizzo and Davey showed that you don't have to be those super, super data obsessed people to succeed. But, you know, it also seems like that's where things are going. So I don't see a team sort of picking someone like him who doesn't have a reputation for that. But I don't think that means the reputation he does have is negative, because I think it's largely positive.
Of course, a lot of folks listening care much more about where the Nats go next. So they hire an interim, you know, who is already on staff. Obviously, that's typically how that goes. Like, do you think that, you know, that's who's in place for the rest of the season, and then they do a wide scope? Do you think a decision is made before then? Like, what do we know at this point, and what do you expect in terms of what's next for the Nats front office and the manager role as well?
Yeah, so they promoted one of Rizzo's longtime assistants, Mike DiBartolo, to assistant GM. He has kind of long been the obvious choice for this situation. Kind of always seemed like maybe someone who could step up if Rizzo wanted to step away. I don't know. We don't know whether, you know, they'll see how the season goes and then, you know, really conduct a search for the best and brightest, or if this is sort of an audition. And because they know Mike DiBartolo, the learners will say, you know, just stay on if you look like you can handle this. So we'll see. I I would expect that decision to come before any decision on a long-term manager. But, you know, I'll be interested to see. You know, I think Mike DiBartolo is actually someone you can trust the reins to. You know, he's someone who's kind of been around and formed his own opinions over the years and probably has a pretty good sense of what it looks like to do this job. So I don't think it'd be crazy if the owners said, you know, just stay, you know, stay in this job and take us forward. But I also think it could be really worthwhile for them to look elsewhere and be willing to really scope for the best possible option. And I'm not sure they will.
Yeah. Even if you have an, like, this is true. If people that are running businesses are listening, I'm sure they're hopefully going to nod along here. But like, if you have a chance to interview people from the outside and get a sense of what they think of your organization and you get a sense of different things that, and different ways of thinking, and you don't take the opportunity to at least expose yourself to that and see what's out there, that's just not smart business. And even if DiBartolo winds up being the best guy, and I thought Barry wrote about this really well in his column, where he's like, even if he winds up being the best guy, like, he's going to have to earn it the same way everyone else does. But if they don't take that opportunity, especially considering Mike's been running this thing since 2009, that just seems like a tremendous missed opportunity, especially because, you know, some of the names that are out there from front offices like Tampa, like the Dodgers, all over baseball that just do things, Chelsea, so differently than the way the Nationals do here.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with the best and brightest, though, is they cost the most. And that's not something the learners have been traditionally willing to do. So if you can get, you know, a pretty good option who's going to be a first-time GM and happy to have the job, they might lean toward that over the best possible option who's going to want, you know, $5 to $10 million or whatever it is a year. So I think we'll learn a lot about how committed to winning the learners are by how they make this decision, which isn't to say I don't think, you know, I think Mike DiBartolo can win, but, you know, I just think we'll know about their seriousness from how they approach this, because, you know, I think in most cases you'd really want a new outside voice. In this case, I think that because Rizzo was such an overpowering personality, there are people in the room who think differently and could create real change without him making the final decision. But you know, it would be extremely silly, I think, for them to miss the chance to really see who they could get.
Yeah, of course, they can also bring in an outside voice from the managerial spot as well. A couple more here for Chelsea Janes, Washington Post, Major League Baseball reporter. And the learners obviously are at the center of this story as much as anybody. And they put out the statement, whatever, a couple months ago, where they're like, nope, we're not selling the team. We're committed to winning, blah, 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 blah. Have you seen any changes since that statement in how they do business, or any signs that, hey, we're getting close to reinvesting in this team in a more serious way, like we did when we were, you know, at the top of the NL East every year and trying to make runs and ultimately did make a run to the World Series?
I haven't seen any signs that they're willing to add a lot of payroll. I have not heard about anything from agents that indicates that they are suddenly gearing up for the Nationals to be really active this winter. But I also hadn't heard anyone explicitly rule it out. I don't think anything about what they've been doing indicate, even the jersey patch, which they're going to get a lot of more money from now, or a decent amount of money from. Like, I don't think that changes the equation that dramatically. But, you know, no one has said, we think we're not going to get a chance to spend next year. And, you know, I think even Rizzo at times was like, this feels like the year we need to spend. And so it seemed as if he were optimistic that maybe that would happen. But I don't think anyone knows for sure. And until you see them do it, I would always probably not get one's hopes up.
What about the possibility of them spending on some of the other stuff, though? Like, payroll is one thing, but you can be a lot more efficient with your spending if you know, spend a couple million dollars on R&D versus, you know, I mean, pitchers, especially like good ones, they cost so much money in payroll. So do you think that there's a chance that at the very least the learners would be willing to try something akin to the Rays model, even if they're not willing to go big on free agency? And then I have one more on kind of the payroll spend in the draft before we let you go.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think it depends how they approach the GM search. I think if they do a GM search and are blown away by someone who says, hey, you don't have to spend, we'll win, it's very hard for me to imagine them passing that up. You know, so it might just be a question of whether they trust someone to allocate funds into the R&D stuff. I don't, like, I wouldn't rule it out especially if they see someone presents that to them credibly as a cost-effective measure long-term. But I don't know. It'll be really, really interesting to see. I think they need to do that, but I don't know if someone will be able to pitch them on it in a different way than has been tried previously.
All right. So then the last two kind of related would be with DeBarlow here over the next couple of weeks. Like, what do we think they'll do here at the trade deadline? I mean, I was reading like Mackenzie Gore is at the same service time and the same place away from free agency that Soto was. And so like there's a bold move to be made if you want to move off the one great pitcher that you have. Obviously, I think a lot of fans would be like, no, please stop trading away all the good players. And then you have the draft that's a week from today and a not a clear number one pick, which in baseball gets real confusing real quick because you could take a bit of a lesser player who you know you can sign at lesser money because of how the money pool works in the Major League Baseball draft compared to, I think, what most fans are used to in the NFL and NBA draft where the salaries are slotted based off your pick. So with all that said, Chelsea, like what do the next, let's say the rest of July look like for DeBartolo and the rest of this new Nationals interim front office?
You know, my understanding, you know, I've been around Mike DeBartolo for many years, and I would describe him as a rational actor. Like, I think he is just someone who's going to do something, things that make sense. So when it comes to the trade deadline, I think he'll sell everyone, you know, all the guys on expiring contracts and try to get something back. You know, he was a big proponent of trading Juan Soto when they did. So could he have pictured a world in which they trade Mackenzie Gore? Probably. Will he have the mandate from ownership to like make a move that big? I don't know. But I also don't know that he would think it was the right thing to do. Like, I don't think he, you know, I don't think we know enough to think he would want to come in with that kind of splash. But as for the draft, you know, I think he will listen to the people who have been scouting these guys for weeks and months. And that's not to say Mike Rizzo wouldn't have. But I think this was probably a pick that was going to be Mike Rizzo's pick the whole way because it's too important. It's first overall. It's huge for the franchise. So I was expecting it to be very predictable, like a big pitcher from college. And there were two or three names that made sense, and it was probably going to be one of them. Now, I think Mike DeBartolo will listen to, you know, the guys in the department who maybe Rizzo would have overruled, and maybe they'll end up picking the same guy, maybe they won't. But I don't expect him to do anything that'll make anyone's jaw drop in the immediate future with Mike DeBartolo.
All right, that's Chelsea Janes. You can read more of her and her colleagues reporting in the Washington Post at WashingtonPost.com/sports. They've got a ton of coverage of everything around Rizzo, Davey, and the end of their tenures with the Nats. Chelsea, thanks so much. As always, I'm sure we'll be talking here over the next couple of weeks as more things happen, and appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Chelsea Janes with us on The Hoffman Show. When we get back, going to play a game that can explain how the Nationals could be successful moving forward if they'll spend just a little bit of money in the right places.